It's an interesting election season, put mildly, and there are some striking numbers out from the Democracy Institute, one of the polling outlets that I very much take a listen to. As everybody, as most people know, I'm not the biggest fan of public polling, but the Democracy Institute is a place that is definitely worth hearing out. And its director, Patrick Basham, has quite a bit to say on this episode of News Site. I'm your host, Joseph Cotto. Good evening, everyone. And thank you for being here, Patrick.
My pleasure, Joseph. Always great to be with you and your fine audience. Looking forward to another interesting discussion.
And me as well. For a second, I thought there was going to be a tech glitch, but thankfully that's not the case. Anyway, Patrick, we'll be getting some very interesting findings from the DI. Why don't you, though, if for anybody who, bizarre as it may sound, may not be familiar with you or the Democracy Institute, why don't you explain both of you?
Well, the Democracy Institute is a public policy research organization. We've been around since 2006. We focus on all manner of public policy, foreign policy, domestic, a lot of public health, a lot of economics, a lot of democratization, geopolitical work. But we also do other things. We're very much about the empiricism, about bringing data to bear, evidence-based policy prescriptions, recommendations, and critiques. And so public polling is something that we do and have done increasingly over the last few years, especially since 2016 with Brexit and Trump's election. For several years now, we've been doing the American polling for the Daily Express, the Express family of newspapers in the United Kingdom. The Daily Express now has a US website. And so we poll every month during election season for the Express. We do other polling as well, but that's the polling that tends to take most of our time on this side of the on the American side of the pond, and for which we receive the most amount of plaudits and especially the most amount of criticism of brickbats. So we are, and then we also have a good collection of cats working for the polling unit, as you can probably tell. They're always on cue. And no, so we find that our polling is, we find it interesting. Other people find it interesting, and so it's always a welcome opportunity to discuss with you, Joseph, and your audience how we're seeing things looking at any given point in the American political calendar.
Absolutely. I've been speaking with Patrick for a few years now, and it's always great to get his insight. Donald Trump thought very highly of the Democracy Institute during the last presidential election, and 538 is not a fan of the DI at all. So I guess that sort of tells you where public perception is coming from. But certainly over the last few years, the DI has received more and more recognition for its great work, and that is something long overdue. Can you hear me, Patrick? I believe Patrick has frozen, which does happen from time to time. It's one of those things totally unavoidable in broadcasting, but what are you going to do? Anyhow, though, I will be getting some very interesting numbers with Patrick. I did mention them before, and I have a lot more to say about them. I'm sure he does as well as soon as he returns. I don't want to get too far into anything now, but there is a lot here to look over, and I do look forward to doing so. Patrick has returned. Patrick, I just paid a compliment to the Democracy Institute, but
Oh.
I think you might have frozen out before you heard it.
Sure. Well, compliments for we don't drown in them generally. So happy to hear it again, just 'cause just say that in your intro, you mentioned that there hadn't been what you had feared was to be a technical glitch, and I was tempted to say temp, but I feared it would tempt fate. However, fate is what the gods have not favored us, is that the technical glitches were waiting for me to start talking. And that's when we tend to get more than our share, it seems. But anyway, enough about that.
Yeah, tech issues are unavoidable. But I was saying that Donald Trump thinks very highly of the DI, and 538 does not. So that lets you know where public perception is coming from. But in any case, over the last few years, you finally have got something not quite of your due, but getting closer to it.
Yeah, we've been, no pollster is perfect. We've been largely quite successful, and we've had a very successful run so far in Canada, electoral calendar year 2024 in terms of the primaries, Super Tuesday, et cetera. So, we're very pleased with our work, including our most recent work. But, there's no resting on laurels. You have to keep improving, trying to improve. Trying to learn from your mistakes and your misses and your errors, which we hope to do. And fortunately, because our work is more right than wrong, increasingly people are interested in those services and interested in listening and reading and watching about what it is we're finding at any given point.
Now, getting into your most recent numbers, they are interesting in a host of ways. In your most recent poll, you found that Joe Biden, who is obviously the president, was dubbed the biggest fool in American politics. This sobering revelation underscores a growing sentiment among Americans regarding their dissatisfaction with Biden's performance and leadership. With the 2024 elections looming closer and the specter of another showdown with Donald Trump on the horizon, Biden's ratings continue to plummet, painting a grim picture of his tenure in the White House. The poll, which surveyed 1,500 likely voters across party lines, including Democrats, Republicans, and Independents, revealed a significant consensus among respondents regarding Biden's perceived incompetence. A staggering 30% of participants labeled Biden as the biggest fool, while an unexpected 22% of Democrats favor Trump over Biden in this regard. Vice President Kamala Harris fared no better, coming in third with 14% of the vote. These numbers reflect a deep-seated disillusionment with the current administration, cutting across party affiliations and ideologies. Obviously, it's interesting to be called the biggest fool in April. The poll was released for April, so there is that. Patrick, anything to say about what I just brought up?
Well, I think one caveat is important, and the caveat is this, that, and it's counterintuitive perhaps in a normal political environment, which America 2024 is not, and that is if you are labeled by some distance the greatest political fool in a country, and you are running for re-election, logic would suggest that you don't have much chance. But the caveat is that that doesn't apply to Biden. Right. So, but so back to the numbers, I mean, Biden is clearly seen as the biggest fool because just about all Republicans, contemporary Republicans, believe him to be. And other Democrats like Harris and AOC also fare poorly, but of course not as poorly as Biden because he is the president. He is the most well-known, the most prominent of them. Now, of course, many Democrats think that Trump's the biggest fool to come along in quite a while. So he comes second in a race you don't want to win or be near the top of. And other Republicans also, do poorly. So I think what it tells you is that it speaks to the hostility against both Biden and Trump in the opposing camps in partisan terms. It also tells you that most of the current and obvious replacements, potential successors to the likes of Biden and Trump, have their own issues, challenges in terms of favorability, perception, reputation, right? But as I said at the beginning of my answer, Joseph, one of the great puzzles of contemporary American politics is that a president such as Joe Biden, who is so unpopular and so disfavored and so clearly presiding, figuratively speaking anyway, over the decline of a nation, could nevertheless remain in such a competitive position overall, right? But that is where we find ourselves. And I mean, there's no simple answer, but there are a variety of answers that, you know, collectively, cumulatively, get us somewhere near the nub of what's going on. But fundamentally, the most important of them is that although a great many Democrats are massively underwhelmed and disappointed by Biden's presidency, most of them are still willing to vote for him to be reelected because they continue to dislike, stroke, hate Donald Trump. Most of them are not willing, for a variety of reasons, to support someone like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. So Biden is bent, for all the things that are hurting Biden, all the challenges he faces in his re-election campaign, he benefits massively from the fact that many Democrats are holding their noses and are willing to vote for him as a vote against Trump, just as in 2020. You know, there was very little of any pro-Biden vote, but there was a massive anti-Trump vote. It's a counterintuitive dynamic and situation we find ourselves in, but, you know, isn't everything about America 2024?
You know, it's interesting because a lot of Republicans say, well, if we had a less divisive candidate than Donald Trump, then the Democrats would be in a worse position. But there has been extreme antipathy towards every Republican presidential nominee I can remember since George W. Bush running for re-election. In 2000, it was more of a typical, or what was then typical, American presidential election. But after Bush won so narrowly, some would argue he really didn't win, but that's another story for another time, in 2000, there began to be this extreme hatred among the Democratic base of any Republican who was running for president, whereas they disliked the person before and their politics. It was sort of, very much a political disagreement, but it became deeply personal after the way Bush, depending on how you look at it, won in 2000. Since then, it's just ratcheted up to the point that now any Republican basically is going to be demonized, and the Democrats will turn out against this Republican because he or she is the worst thing in the world. That was, you know, the label Keith Olbermann gave people he disliked, almost always on the right, worst person in the world. And he's someone who played a massive role in galvanizing reflexive Democratic opposition to anything vaguely right of center, let alone right wing. So it's really interesting to see how the Democrats have reacted to Republican presidential nominees over the years, how it has changed. But I would argue that the hatred that you see exhibited towards Trump would be exhibited towards any Republican who is running. I remember when John McCain was running, John Lewis said that McCain echoed the words of George Wallace, and Mitt Romney was treated as a threat to democracy, by the way. It's someone who is going to roll back the rights of women. So basically the same rhetoric you hear against Trump was used against others who were far more accommodating of Democrats than he is. So it's really interesting how this goes. I think that there is just a behavioral, and by this point, cultural expectation among the Democratic base that every Republican is Hitler, even if these Democrats have turned on Israel. How ironic is that? Because they say it's quote unquote Nazi, go figure. But these people will look at any Republican presidential nominee as being the worst person in the world, and they will turn out accordingly, even though turning out based on hatred is not as reliable for the party that tries to benefit from this as turning out based on a hope for positive change. Hatred motivates the base, but doesn't go too far beyond that. Some people in the base are just going to get tired and not turn out, but the Democrats have been playing the Republican is not just someone we really disagree with and want to see lose, but pure evil thing since 2004, I would say. And Trump is just the latest Republican to come along and deal with this. Patrick, anything to say about what I brought up?
Well, you've provided a characteristically eloquent and insightful overview, Joseph, of you know, how this has played out over the last 20 years, you know, especially when it comes to Democratic voters' views of Republican candidates. I mean, you can lay upon that almost perfectly media treatment, mainstream media treatment of Republican candidates. You know, every election post George W. Bush, McCain, Romney, etc., prior to their nominations, the New York Times and the Washington Post and all the other august organs of, you know, liberal thought in America were always informing their viewers, oh, if only the Republicans would nominate someone moderate and sensible, like a John McCain or a Mitt Romney, you know, then we'd have a real competition. And, you know, what would we do then? Who would we support then? And of course, the moment that a McCain or a Romney is nominated, as you've highlighted, Joseph, they become not simply less than they were said to be prior to the nomination, but they become the devil incarnate of American politics. They are racist. They want to dismantle the welfare state. They want to throw Granny off the cliff after taking her Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid away and all the rest of it, right? And it was, you know, as Joe Biden famously said about Mitt Romney, he wants to put you, you know, he told black audiences he wants to put you back in chains, right? And I guess given Biden's, shall we say, brushes with the more segregationist elements of post-World War II American politics, he probably was better judge of these things than most of us. But, you know, so the bottom line is that Republican candidates, whatever their utility, whatever their worth as potential presidents, didn't stand a chance after George W. Bush with the media. And consequently, as that's where Democrats get their information, the mainstream media, they didn't stand a chance with those voters either. And so you had a situation by 2015, 2016, where, you know, the Republican base, conservative voters, et cetera, had just become completely fed up with losing. And I think they felt that they weren't losing a fair fight in the sense that, yeah, I mean, everybody knows the media is, as far as anyone can remember, been biased in favor of the Democratic candidate. But the media had become so lopsided through the Obama years and its love for Hillary Clinton that, you know, no Republican could get any kind of decent coverage at all. Like, it was just, you know, almost entirely negative. And I think what compounded that in practice, but I think what really infuriated Republican base voters in particular was that their candidates didn't seem to have the fight in them that was required to push back. You know, they just seemed to, in terms of the media, in terms of the Democrats, they seemed to almost be embarrassed about their positions, the party's platform. They were always on defense. They're never on offense, right? The default position was to somehow try to excuse or wriggle out of what a conservative platform was or should be and what a conservative presidency might look like, and to sort of distance themselves from conservative ideas and conservative politicians, with the probably exception of Reagan, because by this time Reagan had sort of taken up a position sort of above the fray and with a sort of true statesman-like status and aura, to the point where even Democrats didn't criticize him anymore, even though they hated him, abhorred him when he was president. And so I think Republican voters, conservative voters, were crying out for someone who was going to be unapologetically against the Democrats and against most of their liberal agenda and liberal record, and would be on offense, not defense, would be aggressive and assertive, would call out the media, would take on the media, you know, that basically was, you know, was brave and courageous and not cowardly and frightened and hiding in the corner. And so whatever the utility of Donald Trump's platform in 2015 and 16, he struck so many of his party's primary voters as so different from what they had been experiencing and someone who was up for the fight. And whether he could win or not, whether he'd be the greatest president or not, I think they were captured, captivated, and therefore he was able to capture their support by the fact that his heart really seemed to be in it, right? And he wasn't afraid to go toe-to-toe with anybody, his fellow Republican candidates, you know, the hosts of the debates, you name it. He just took them on, and it didn't matter what was said about him. He just kept moving forward. And so whether you like that style or not, whether you think that makes him good or bad or somewhere in between, it resonated with the Republican voters. It gained traction. And of course, that has been central to his success electorally, politically, ever since. And so stylistically, we have someone in Donald Trump who's been phenomenally successful. And some would say the conventional wisdom is despite his communication style. I mean, I would argue that much of his success is directly, explicitly because of his communication style, right? But we have the larger question of larger issue, conundrum to many, of why we're having these two guys again going head to head after 2020. Our polling for The Express, it's for an American audience. The Express is new American audience, but it's obviously also for the domestic British audience and more globally, as our polling has received, you know, so much traction over the last few years. And I preface my remarks with that because I'm frequently asked, especially outside of this country, how is it that America has ended up with Trump and Biden again? And what I was telling folks before the primaries and during the primaries, when it was still to be decided, at least on paper, and of course reinforced now, is that the reason you have these two candidates going up against each other once more is because they both represent their party's best chances of retaining and recapturing the White House. And people, you know, say, well, that's, how can that be? You know, Biden's not popular in the country. You know, half the country hates Trump, da 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 da. But of course, Biden, you put Biden and the other potential Democratic candidates, Kamala Harris, Hillary Clinton, you name it, up against Trump or another leading Republican. And Biden does best by some distance. Trump or DeSantis or Nikki Haley, Tim Scott, you put that selection up against Biden, and Trump does best and by some distance. It's always been that way. And so both parties needed to renominate both those gentlemen because they give themselves the best chance, even though a majority of the country don't think that they are the best candidates. Yet within their parties, they do, because they recognize that overall, when all is said and done, there are advantages to each candidacy, or should I say, there are fewer disadvantages to that candidacy than another partisan of the same stripe. And that especially applies on the Biden side of things. So again, it's this counterintuitive situation, dynamic we find ourselves experiencing, and it potentially makes things more unpredictable. It makes it all seem a little back to the future, a little deja vu all over again. But what else would we expect from such a surreal, crazy, upside down political culture and public policy making environment? When you think of what has gone on and what has been allowed and what has quote unquote succeeded over the last few years, why wouldn't we have Biden against Trump again? Very little has made sense over the last few years. So why should this?
I'm not surprised at all by what happened. I would have been surprised if this did not happen. The Democrats want Biden because he's easy to control. He's obviously not running his administration. Other people are acting on his behalf. The issue with the whole trans day of visibility is a perfect example. He had a proclamation in his name saying that Easter was a trans holiday. And then when he was questioned about it, he said, I don't know anything about that. I never signed it. Meanwhile, the proclamation, it was his. Yeah. As a matter, it was officially his, a proclamation from his office on official federal letterhead. So, this just goes to show he's not running his administration, period. There are no two ways about that.
We may find that Biden campaigns such as he does against his own administration, right? Because I think the pollsters for Biden have recently been replaced, and that's either because they were telling the truth too consistently, or maybe just they weren't they were way off. But I suspect it's the former, because they did a good job in 2020. You know, they were pretty much in line with the Trump pollsters. And both were very much in line with our polling. And that's why it was, you know, we knew, they both knew it was going to be such a close outcome. So Biden is, if he, you know, if he's juiced up enough to be aware of what's going on, if he's in a debate with Trump and he's, you know, temporarily alert and cogent, then he may say all kinds of things that don't sound like his proclamations or his policies, his administration's presidency. And of course, most of what he'll say in opposition to that will be more popular than the policies themselves. And it would perversely help him. I mean, the analogy I would give was back to, you mentioned the 2000 election, Joseph, I mean, George W. Bush and Al Gore. And it was a very interesting thing, because Al Gore was in this slightly surreal scenario where he's running to succeed a reelected, comparative, by 2000, reasonably popular president, good approval ratings, even if his presidency was, there were obviously dark clouds over certain elements of it. So the country was perceived to be, had gone into recession at the end of Clinton's presidency, but perceived to be doing well, dot-com boom and all that. And it was up to George W. Bush as the opposition candidate to rail against all the failings. But of course, Al Gore, he wanted to be his own man, and he wanted to be as sort of populist and passionate about his candidacy. And so he would his message was basically, you've never had it so good, and I'm mad as hell about it, and I'm not going to take it anymore, right? So he would give these fiery, over-the-top speeches, which were the sort of an opposition candidate style, while celebrating the successes of his and Clinton's co-presidency, as he liked to think of it. And so it's that sort of schizophrenic approach that vice presidential candidates can adopt. Unsuccessfully, as it turns out in Gore's case, a little more successfully in George Bush Sr.'s case in 1988 against Michael Dukakis, succeeding Ronald Reagan, successfully, attempting to and actually succeeding Ronald Reagan. But Biden, he needs to run against himself to some extent. They have to persuade the progressives and the lefties on their side to hold their noses and to keep as quiet as possible through the election, so that they can focus all their attention not on keeping the party united, or reuniting it, maybe is a better way of putting it, a more accurate way of putting it, but on focusing all their ammunition on Trump to, again, replay 2020 and do the, anybody's better than Trump, therefore I'm better than Trump thing, which is a much harder sell, because Biden was unknown as a president in 2020, but he's rather well known now. Everything is upside down. You have a former president running to be president again. I mean, this doesn't happen very often. So both Biden and Trump have challenges and opportunities that are not unheard of, but are not the norm. And how their campaigns respectively navigate those challenges, those opportunities, is going to go a long way to deciding, who wins this thing in the end.
To say the least. As I was saying, So the Democrats are keeping Biden because he's easy to control. That's it. That's the reason. And of course, that he is, bizarre as it may seem, more electable than Kamala Harris. They really could not have her resign and have Biden be replaced by, say, Gavin Newsom, another white male. It would cause problems with their intersectional base, which prioritizes, among other things, ancestral identity. Gender identity. So the Democrats basically have to keep Biden because they benefit from him and as a practical concern in re-election. Now, talking about Republicans and Trump, it's unfinished business. It's unfinished business because most Republicans believe Trump did not actually lose in 2020 and because they liked the way his presidency was running, at least until COVID. So it's natural to renominate Trump. That explains why it's Biden and Trump right now. It's something that a lot of people, most people are very disturbed by. They don't like their choices. You really can't blame them, but those are the choices. Although, of course, there are many third-party candidates now, which speaks to the the intense voter dissatisfaction with Trump and Biden. Jill Stein on the left, also Cornel West on the left, and RFK is a left-leaning populist who has a great deal of crossover with the right. So, and whatever remains of the center. So it's a fascinating election season. The Biden campaign only takes RFK seriously as a real vote detractor. So now the DNC has come out with a new anti-third-party campaign machine, which is really aimed at RFK because they're not taking West or Stein seriously, although they should, because West and Stein speak to the growing, intense Democratic base voter dissatisfaction with how Biden has handled the war between Israel and Hamas. So it's interesting, to say the least, what's going on now. Patrick, before I move on with my monologue, what is your perspective on this very, very pronounced Democratic voter rage towards Biden about the Middle Eastern situation? Because it has been more intense than I imagined. Yeah. It is enduring. It's, in fact, growing. Nancy Pelosi just called spectacularly, because she's been a great supporter of Israel over the years, but she spectacularly called for the U.S. to no longer give weapons to Israel. So obviously, where she's from, San Francisco, she's feeling the heat from her Democratic-based voters. But Biden has, even though he's getting wobbly and he's putting asterisks and conditions on his support for Israel, he cannot readily walk that back. Number one, because he campaigned to a great deal of Democratic donors who are pro-Israel. He needs their support again. Number two, because it would be too obvious of a turnaround. Number three, because it would give the GOP a big opening with single-issue pro-Israel donors. So the fact of the matter is Biden is definitely in a jam. But the Democratic base voters are turning out against him. They're voting uncommitted, or whatever the equivalent is, in states where this option is available. So these people are not terribly predisposed to turn out for Biden in the general election. They are predisposed to either stay home or vote for Stein or West. They wouldn't vote for RFK because he is pro-Israel. So, Patrick, what do you think about Biden's issue with these severely demotivated Democratic-based voters?
Yeah, well, I mean, as someone whose sort of business card claims he's got his finger on the pulse of the American electorate, I've been a little bit surprised, as it sounds, you have been, Joseph, by the extent and the degree to which Biden's detractors on Israel have sort of made hay, and how many of them there are, right? And it's, you know, when October 7th, if I got my calendar right, you know, when Hamas attacked Israel, and in the following days and weeks, it was predictable that some Democrats in Congress, a portion of the base, a sort of predictable portion of the base, elements of the party, ideologically and geographically, in Minnesota and in Michigan in particular, would take umbrage and would make some noise about this, and that it could be unhelpful to Biden. However, the immediate rallying around the Israeli flag on the part of the Biden administration suggested that they understood where the American public was and probably would be on this issue, and that giving, you know, at least wholehearted at least rhetorical support to Israel and their right to self-defense would be able to at least survive it, even if not necessarily gain from it. And that Biden would use it as part of the, you know, we defend those countries who are attacked, you know. So whether it was Ukraine or Israel, you know, they sort of stitch all this stuff together further to the, you know, we're the defenders of international law and a democratic world, another democracy being under assault, that kind of thing. But I think what we should have been able to predict, but the Biden administration never ceases to surprise us with its degree of incompetence, is how poorly politically they've handled this. Because whether you think it's smart to sort of tie yourself to the Israeli mast on this and just stick with them all the way, or whether you think that the Biden administration sort of edged back sooner than they have, change the rhetoric sooner, you know, where they should or should not have pushed for ceasefires and when they should have done so and what they should have done at the UN, all that. I think it's pretty clear that the Biden administration has fumbled all of this. Like, you know, just everything they've done, it's you know, coming on the heels of the Afghanistan withdrawal debacle and the Ukraine war debacle. This is now the third major international conflict where it's pretty clear that the Biden administration is over its skis, right? They simply can't handle these kinds of issues. They don't predict them. I mean, in some cases, one could argue quite strongly that they actually precipitate some of them, but you know, they certainly can't predict them. And once they happen, once the shock and horror is over, they don't know whether to stick or twist. They make very poor decisions, sort of on the hoof. They're not good at spontaneous decision making, and the calculus is really poor. They're terrible chess players. So not only do they not understand that they need to work out their moves, what moves they'll need to make further on down the board, they can't. They're no good at assessing and understanding the current and likely future moves of their opponent or opponents, right? So they just get themselves in a complete mess. I mean, they can't strategize themselves out of a wet paper bag, right? I mean, they just can't. And it's, you know, there's no leadership from Biden. I mean, he's always been atrocious like most foreign policy experts in America, particularly on the Democratic side, but not exclusively by any stretch. They tend to be terrible at foreign policy, right? It's what Vivek said in that debate when he was speaking directly at Nikki Haley, but in the term of that actual debate, but making the larger point, is that American foreign policy establishment, Democrat and Republican, is filled with alleged experts who have tons of foreign policy experience and very, very little foreign policy wisdom. And the Biden administration, stacked as it is with failed Obama foreign policy types and failed Clinton foreign policy types, just is the poster child for lots of experience and very little, if any, wisdom. And so they fumbled and all the way through this. They don't know what they want to do, because all they want to do is minimize vote loss and maximize vote gain. You know, I think that there's very little principle involved here. They'd be 110% in favor of everything Israel might do. If that was clearly the thing that was going to help Biden, they'd be 110% in favor of what Hamas may or may not do and what Hamas did on October 7th. If that was what was going to give Biden the best prospects of re-election. And it's so transparent, right? And so this gives those who are on the quote-unquote Palestinian side, or certainly not on the Israeli side, so much more running room when they critique Biden, because it's very hard within the party at this stage, and for weeks and months, for those on the Biden side to say, but yeah, you know, stick with us because we've got this great plan, or we're adhering to such principle and we're defending this and, you know, and all the rest of it, which might be true, but it's not obvious, to put it mildly, right? And so there's been insufficient effective pushback against the pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas, anti-Israeli part of the Democratic Party, which has been revealed to be far more significant than most of us thought it was, just both numerically and in terms of its political effectiveness. And so, as you rightly say, Joseph, for that reason and a host of others, the Democrats themselves are quite divided, in the sense that they are massively, many of them are massively underwhelmed and disappointed by Biden. And so, as you say, you have this non-Biden / anti-Biden vote in the primaries. And so while from the get-go, once Kennedy realized he wasn't going to get a fair shake at the nomination and left the Democrats and began his independent candidacy, all the attention was on Trump, Trump DeSantis, you know, can Trump do it? Will he be toppled, et cetera? And that was fitting and appropriate. However, there's been insufficient attention on the Democratic side. The fact that Joe Biden, with no credible opposition, was losing 10, 20, 25% of the vote in primaries here, there, and everywhere to voters who wouldn't commit to support him, which is a terrible sign, a really poor leading indicator and signal of Biden's, the enthusiasm for Biden among his party, for November. And particularly as those who aren't supporting him in the primaries, those are disproportionately base voters. They are the ones who are the most, these days, the most left-wing, the most anti-Israel, the most pro-Palestinian. And so the issue itself matters at the margins. You know, most foreign policy issues don't dominate, but it matters at the margin, the Israel-Hamas issue. But it's because it fits the pattern, the foreign policy pattern of this presidency, and it's not an attractive one to many Democrats, let alone Republicans and independents. It turns foreign policy, with the Ukraine war continuing to wage, in the sense that the Russians continue to do what they want in Ukraine, the Ukrainians can't do anything about it, and it's becoming blindingly obvious to a majority of Americans that their money has been wasted and will continue to be wasted. That foreign policy and Biden's poor record becomes less a marginal issue and potentially a more central issue to the voting calculus of many a voter. So it speaks to Biden's fundamental problem, which is not that he's too left-wing a president, which he is, not that his policies were always going to fail, which they have, but the fact that he and those he's put in all these important influential decision-making positions are simply not up to the job. He never was. He hired people who weren't and aren't. And, you know, many folks can handle failure if they think you're smart, you're well-intentioned, it just didn't work out, you didn't get the rub of the green. And particularly if it's your president, they'll stick with you, because after all, you're not the other guy. But there's an increasingly sizable minority of Democratic voters who are starting to question whether they can do that, because, yeah, they may be well-intentioned, and yeah, some of these people may be smart, at least on paper, and maybe they've been unlucky in certain regards. But God, they just don't seem to be able to, you know, walk straight. You know, they're just not up to it. They're just not competent people, at least not in these positions. And once you have that reputation, it's really, really, really hard to get back the competence vibe. And after all, you know, Biden was a generic, nondescript machine politician his entire political career. He wasn't exactly known to be Mr. Competence. I mean, how many jobs did Obama have to fire him from? I mean, Obama's famous line about, you know, you can always rely on Joe to F things up. He got elected because he was the least worst option for the Democrats to pick, and he wasn't Trump, right? He didn't get elected because people thought he was the guy. So the bar was low, but he's managed to fall below that. And the people really acting as president and making those decisions, they have fewer excuses than him. They have less physical and mental challenges to overcome on a daily basis than he does. But they have fallen so far short of what Americans expected from any presidency, let alone this, where the adults were, we were told, we're going to be back in charge. Well, it turns out the
Oh, I believe Patrick has left us, however briefly, but I'm sure he'll be right back. I agree with his commentary about the Biden administration. I doubt many people would be surprised to learn that. I always struggle to figure out what to say when the Biden administration comes up because, at this point, it is what it is. People know that from having seen it for 3 years now, three very tumultuous years, and they will make their decision in the general election. I think that a lot of people will support the Biden administration simply because it's Team Blue and they hate Team Red, and that's basically it. Then there are some people on Team Red who hate Team Blue, and they'll support Team Red for that reason. The question is, in these select few truly swing states, who is going to have the better turnout and who can convince the vanishing pool of swing voters? And that remains to be seen, although it looks like now Trump is doing the better job of it than Biden. So it's definitely an interesting state of affairs. Patrick, please continue where you left off.
Yeah, I was just finally, belatedly finishing my whatever small point I was making, Joseph, by saying that Biden's election soar premised on the notion the adults would be back in charge if he won. The adults are back in charge. The problem that's blindingly obvious to everyone, including a good number of Democrats, is that these particular adults are incompetent adults. You know, they're intellectually and policy-making wise adolescents, really, rather than adults. And so, you know, that's the obvious reality. It's very tangible for most Americans, and it's very hard to overcome that that challenge. After three and a half years, will folks give you another chance to prove yourself right, to prove them wrong, that you know that what they now think of you isn't actually who you are in office? Most politicians, most parties, most candidates are unable to overcome that in most situations.
Indeed they are. We'll see what happens this year because it is a very strange year to say the absolute least. And Patrick, before I return to my monologue, which I really have to do, but I just have to ask given the subject matter, what do you think has driven the Democratic base to such a crystallized, at this point, anti-Israel position? It's been going on for several years, the transition, but obviously it's reached critical mass. More than anything else, what do you think has driven this, something that's so severe it's imperiling Biden's re-election chances?
I think it's what's driven it across most of the West, Joseph, which is terrible educational systems, public and private, so especially so ideologically driven. The growth and success politically of identity politics, the victimization of politics, the lack of history in terms of what's taught, how it's taught, what people know. So we have so many quote-unquote well-educated people running around convinced they have the answers to all the world's problems, and they know so little in a fundamental sense, right? So they're 2 + 2 + 2 always equals 12 or 9 or 17 because they don't even know what 2 is to begin with. There's all of these things, I think, it's been a perfect storm that they've crystallized and synthesized. And so you have an easily victimized population. You have a misunderstanding of history and ignorance of history. You have a desire to simplify things very much in very black and white terms when it comes to, I mean, the Middle East of all places. It's very frustrating from the outside, but I think that's where we are. It's probably one of the better examples of how younger adults today in America and across the West are off kilter when it comes to some of the very fundamental issues of our day.
I have to say the absolute least. Now, finally, to return to my monologue, which is, of course, about the Democracy Institute's most recent polling data, one of the key factors contributing to Biden's negative perception is his age and apparent cognitive decline. At 81 years old, Biden's frequent memory lapses and gaps have eroded public confidence in his ability to lead effectively. The Democracy Institute's director, which is, of course, Patrick Basham, pointed out that Biden's own Justice Department acknowledged his cognitive limitations, further reinforcing the notion of his unsuitability for office. Biden's tenure has been marred by a series of missteps and embarrassing incidents, from stumbling on Air Force One stairs to confusing details in press conferences and interviews. These blunders have only served to reinforce the perception of a leader out of touch and ill-equipped to navigate the complexities of governing a nation. However, it's not just Biden's personal shortcomings that have come under scrutiny. His policy decisions have also faced significant criticism. According to the Democracy Institute poll, Americans disapprove of Biden's record as president by a margin of 56% to 40%. Economic policies have fared even worse, with a disapproval rate of 66% to 26%. This discontent is further exacerbated by concerns over foreign policy, where Biden's approval ratings plummet to 28% against a disapproval rate of 67%. Furthermore, a substantial portion of the electorate believes that they were better off under Trump's administration, with 56% expressing this sentiment. A majority also views Trump as a better president compared to Biden, indicating a stark contrast in public opinion between the two leaders. The prevailing belief that the country is headed in the wrong direction further underscores the widespread disillusionment with Biden's leadership. Patrick, I was about to say something else, but anything to say about what I brought up?
Yeah, I mean, this is details fleshing out some of what I was touching on earlier, Joseph, about this conundrum of Biden being so unpopular on almost any specific issue category you care to name, and yet being in a competitive position more or less against Trump. And so you have a country that disapproves of him as president, disapproves overwhelmingly of most of his policies and policy baskets, and yet is willing to give him at least a second look, even if they're not in any way enthusiastic about at the moment about him being reelected. It's the contrast of the Trump situation, where Trump was president and most of his policies were quite popular and became increasingly so, and yet his own approval wasn't good, and he was always in a, you know, at best competitive position, but often seen as being in a bit of a hole vis-a-vis Biden or whomever his Democratic opponent would turn out to be in 2020. So the question was always, can Trump overcome himself? Can he focus on his record enough to get reelected? Where in Biden's case, his record is the problem. It's, can he focus people's attention enough on the alleged failings of his opponent for them to ignore his record? Now, politicians and parties and candidates do this all the time successfully. And in Trump's case in 2020, you know, as an example of when it's actually harder than it might seem to run on a record if the person running on that record isn't the most popular person in the world. However, if you're giving someone a choice, and that person, you know, is clued in terms of how these things work. If your choice is between defending a good record versus a bad record, you'll take the sort of rougher edges of the personal approval and go with the good record rather than the other, you know, as a sort of default position. But again, it's how those are two very different hands to play, and it's how they're played that makes the difference. The last, say, before sort of, not to meander too further, Joseph, away from your monologue, but the polling that we've done for quite a while now that's shown consistently, that you touched on, that people retrospectively have a good impression, a good view, a positive view of Trump's record as president, even more so than they did when he was president. This is a fascinating thing, because we're in this very unusual situation. And I think this is one of Trump's, perhaps his greatest advantage in this election. And it's one that's received the least amount of attention. And it's the following. Normally, an opposition candidate is expected and does launch attack after attack. His candidacy is a critique of the incumbent, if assuming the incumbent's running for re-election, as in the case of Biden. And so the opposition candidate wants to remind people, if it's an unpopular president as Biden is, why they don't like him, and then make some kind of half-convincing case that they would do no worse and possibly do better. But they're asking people to acknowledge what's staring them in the face, that things are not well going well, but to take a leap of faith that they, if they were sort of promoted to that position, that they would do a better job. And sometimes they're successful and sometimes they're not, right? Trump was in 16, Biden was arguably, at least officially, successful narrowly in 2020. But Trump is in a unique and I think very advantageous position because yes, he has to remind people of why they think Biden has failed. He has to present an effective critique of Biden's presidency, but he doesn't have to look at the American voter and say, look, I'm asking you to take a leap of faith. I'm asking you to trust me that I can do as good a job. In fact, I can do a better job. He doesn't have to ask that question because Americans, most of them already know the answer. He just simply has to say, I've already done the job. I did it better than him. He's messed up the good job that I did for you. You know I did better than him. You don't have to trust me. You just have to give me back the keys to the White House. And I will again do that better job. I say that is massively underappreciated and undervalued as an advantage. Now, I would assume that that is something that Trump is going to ram home. It's what he should talk about every single day between now and Election Day.
We shall see what he does. Obviously, Trump has his own way of campaigning, and it's very difficult to, you can sort of generally predict what he'll do, but he always throws curveballs out there that make things interesting, to say the least. This is already an interesting election cycle. Getting back to my monologue, perhaps most damning of all is the perception that the American dream is dying under Biden's presidency, with 61% of respondents expressing the sentiment. This loss of faith in the foundational ideals of the nation speaks to a deeper crisis of confidence in the current political establishment. The recent tragedy involving the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore has only served to exacerbate these concerns. Despite Biden's characterization of the incident as a tragic accident, a significant portion of Americans are inclined to believe otherwise. A poll conducted by the Daily Express U.S. revealed that 41% of respondents attributed the bridge collapse to a cyber attack on the massive container vessel involved, while only 23% believed it was a technical failure. This skepticism towards official narratives reflects a broader trend of distrust in political leaders and mainstream media. Patrick noted that a significant portion of the population no longer trusts established institutions, opting instead to question official explanations and seek alternative perspectives. In light of these developments, it is clear that the Biden administration faces a crisis of legitimacy and trust. The growing disillusionment among Americans, coupled with Biden's own shortcomings and policy failures, paints a stark picture of a nation in turmoil. As the 2024 elections approach, the need for effective leadership and genuine accountability has never been more urgent. The American people deserve leaders they can trust and policies that reflect their aspirations and values. It is incumbent upon the political class to heed these concerns and work towards rebuilding the trust that has been so deeply eroded. Patrick, that's what I have to say, at least for my monologue. Anything that you would like to sound off on?
Well, I mean, the response to the ambivalence among American voters about what may or may not have happened, that wouldn't have been the case, I would argue, not to anything like the degree, the extent 5 years ago. you know, but COVID policy happened, I should say. Ukraine happened. An invasion at the southern border happened. The prosecutions of the January 6th folks happened. The prosecutions of Trump happened. The collusion between the federal government and big tech happened, or should, you know, so it was revealed, right? All of these things, the politicization, the weaponization of the Department of Justice and the FBI, et cetera. All of these things have happened, and they have over time gained traction with not all Americans, but many Americans, and in many of these cases, a majority of Americans. And it's so you have overwhelmingly on the right of American politics, crudely, you know, defined, but also a lot on the left, the populist left, the Sanders left, the Kennedy left, etc. You have a cynicism about government and a cynicism about government, anything official that comes from the government. And so even if folks don't assume poor motives and ill motives on the part of government, of representatives and officials and agencies, etc., they suspect that any official pronouncement, particularly definitive ones, particularly in a time of crisis or tragedy, may well not be accurate or may not even be well-intentioned. They may be intentionally misinforming the public. And so in a case of the bridge collapse, it may be less about the specifics and what is known in the sort of immediate heat of it all, immediate aftermath, than it is the general perception that we simply can't trust these people. So when the, you know, within whatever it was, 6, 7, 8 hours, when the governor of Maryland and various representatives are talking about what they know and what may have happened, and they bring in the FBI guy who says, you know, no evidence of terrorism, you know, nothing to see here, da 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 da. Now, that may be the case, but for the FBI to declare that within such a short space of time doesn't carry the weight that it would have done in the past, when people would just, the default position would be, oh, it's the FBI, accurate until proven otherwise, truthful until proven otherwise. Now, rightly or wrongly, most people think the FBI, what's their agenda? Who's pulling their strings? What are they trying to do? What are they trying to hide from us? What do they not want us to know, right? So that's where you get this unwillingness to just say human error, of course, or just an accident, and you know, stuff happens. People think, nah, was it something else? And that is not going to change with these types of incidents until there is trust regained, not just in our politicians, but in our government institutions and in the bureaucrats and the appointed decision makers who execute, not just execute the president's directives, but in many cases originate those directives or tweak them as they see fit.
It is an interesting time, to say the absolute least. There are some other numbers to get to. These not from my monologue, but from an Express article. As Patrick mentioned, the polling which the Democracy Institute has done for the 2024 presidential election is for the Express, which is an English newspaper. The issue of what happened in Russia, the terrorist attack from ISIS, is something that perhaps not many people in the West are focused on. But it is definitely something worth bringing up. Reading from the article, the polling also revealed that Americans believe that the Moscow terror attack has revealed that ISIS, so-called Islamic State of extremist Islamists, are now back. The Crocus City Hall terror attack by gunmen on March 22nd has seen at least 133 people killed or die of their wounds. Of those polled, 31% believe the Moscow terror attack was ISIS. However, 20% blame Ukraine, and 19% believe it may have been the U.S. government in a sign of suspicion over the Biden regime's foreign policy. Another 13% believe Putin may have ordered the attack himself. I'll stop reading there. So, Patrick, this is interesting because it speaks to what you were just saying, wherein there is very much distrust of official narratives. To see people have such divergent views on something that would have seemed open and shut a few years back, definitely is a sign of the times.
Absolutely. I mean, you imagine 5-10 years ago, when ISIS was in its heyday, ISIS claims, quote, you know, claims responsibility right away, open and shut case. Whether we like Russia or not, whether we like Putin or not, you know, a lot of Russians died. Some people are going to be sad about that. Some people are not going to be so sad. But everybody hates ISIS, and it's, you know, just a sign that they're, you know, alive and sadly well and effective. But because of all the stuff I just talked about, and specifically because of Ukraine, you know, you have a majority of Americans now who don't want any more funds to go, who recognize that this thing is at best a stalemate, but increasingly they recognize that Russia is either winning or has won, will win. And so they want it done and dusted, right? I mean, no, you know, America's on the losing side. Maybe it was an honorable fight. Maybe they were on the side of the angels. They had morality and ethics on their side. Maybe they didn't. But no country likes to lose. And Americans, you know, have a part of the national character is they don't tend to celebrate losing or losers. And we like to move on if our politicians will let us. And I think most Americans, it's not simply the right to lose, but the country seems to be losing so badly domestically. We don't want to focus on that anymore. You know, we were interested for a while. We cared for a while. It didn't work out. Probably was a big mistake. Certainly was a costly one. So let's do this other thing. And in the meantime, I mean, so how they've gotten there is they've seen how incompetently the whole thing's been run. And they've increasingly figured out that things weren't as black and white, weren't as white hats and black hats, weren't as sort of, we're on the side of the angels, that's the devil's side, quite necessarily as sort of Western media and Western politicians have suggested. That's been something that starting to gnaw at a lot of Americans. Maybe they were sold a bill of goods here somewhere along the way, right? And so there's a skepticism of what's gone on and going on in Ukraine vis-a-vis the Ukrainian government and Putin and all of that. But above all, there's a skepticism of what our government tells us what went on, right? So when the American government is very happy to, you know, run with the ISIS thing, half the country at least immediately says, well, but they lie about everything. You know, they lie about what's happening on our street that we can tangibly demonstrate is a lie. Why, you know, why wouldn't they lie about what happens in Russia, right? And so, sure, a lot of people say, well, ISIS claim responsibility. ISIS are bad guys. They do terrorist attacks whenever they can. Okay, they pulled this off. And some people think, well, it might be Al-Qaeda. And some people, I mean, there's a great deal of dislike, hatred of Russia, especially of Putin himself. So you've got some Americans say, well, the whole thing was, you know, a false flag. The whole thing was Putin trying to get either sympathy for Russia or more likely an excuse to do more terrible things to the Ukrainians, right? But you've got a really sizable part of the American electorate that's saying, I don't know, maybe the Ukrainians were behind this. You know, they're trying to, you know, assassinate someone important or just show that the that they're, you know, this isn't over. They can hit the Russians, which of course is something the Ukrainians have and our people, American spokespeople have been saying that, you know, is actually policy to have these these ad hoc episodic strikes within Russia, and it's happened all for 2 years occasionally, but now it seems to be central to the Ukrainian strategy. So it's not exactly. He's not connecting too many difficult dots, convoluted dots, to reach that conclusion. So did the Ukrainians do it? Did we do it because we want to give Putin as many black eyes as we can? Or did the Brits do it? I mean, MI6 and those guys, they got their fingers in so many pies. So again, you see Americans divided between those who are still willing to give our leaders, our officialdom, our decision makers the benefit of the doubt, and our allies, in this case Ukraine, the benefit of the doubt. But then at least an equal number who aren't, who no longer assume that, you know, that partisanship and misinformation and dishonesty among politicians, you know, ends at the water's edge. Just because it's about important foreign matters, you know, these characters in Washington are as likely, if not more likely, to lie to us about it than they are about something domestic. So, which actually, you know, is logical, right? There's less we know and there's less we can do about it. So why wouldn't they if they're that way inclined? So this, again, is a perhaps surprising to some counterintuitive, but I think actually quite to be expected outcome when you consider how cynical, underwhelmed, disappointed, turned off at least half of the American electorate is when it comes to what politicians in general, but particularly national politicians and Washington politicians, have to say about anything of importance. There just isn't the trust, there isn't the acceptance, there isn't the willingness to simply believe what they're told. And whether you think that's a health, you know, whether you think it's an unhealthy situation that we've reached, or whether going forward that's a healthy or unhealthy part of the national character now, the reality is it's there. And you see in these sorts of results that that is really, really stark and striking, and that it applies to some of the most important issues that are being faced, not just here in America, but around the world.
Absolutely. It is a very distressing time, and in times of distress, people believe all sorts of things, which they typically would not. And that's part of human nature. It's not an American thing in particular. It's really, I mean, this election cycle certainly is producing a lot of apathy, which works in Trump's favor, because a lot of the people who are really turned off are the Biden supporters who obviously hate Trump. I should say would-be Biden supporters who obviously hate Trump, but they are severely demoralized with Biden, particularly because of the Middle Eastern issue. You know, there are also Republicans who very much dislike Biden, but they also hate Trump, and they're demoralized too. So, it cuts both ways, but Trump, I think, comes out on the, he benefits from the demoralization more than Biden does. As we wrap things up, Patrick, do you think that's a fair assessment on my end?
Well, absolutely. I mean, these things, you know, when things are going badly, it's almost always the case that to some extent it hurts the incumbent, right? The incumbent party. It may not be fatal. It may be at the margin. We don't know yet what that's going to look like in November. But you have to be a fairly incompetent opponent or opposing party to not benefit, at least to some extent. And it might be, you know, it might be crucial. It might be tantamount to everything you need for a big victory. And so on the Democratic side, I mean, the Biden people can't get out of their own way, but the Democratic Party as a machine is remains incredibly effective as a get out the vote operation, as an operation that is willing to do anything and everything to focus like a laser beam on their opponents and their weaknesses and imaginary weaknesses and manufactured weaknesses. And so Republicans and the Trump campaign, I don't imagine they are, but they would be foolhardy, to say the least, to underestimate what's in store for them over the next 6 months. And on the Republican side, Trump has demonstrated, I think, twice that he is up to the fight, up to the job. And I think that we should, you know, with a reasonable degree of confidence, expect that he is going to maximize his advantages in this campaign and exploit the weaknesses of his opponent, you know, to quite a large degree. And that will stand him in very good stead against Biden. And you know, at this point, it looks like it should be, barring some seismic change in voter sentiment or some seismic shock externally to the system, it should stand him in pretty good stead, perhaps very good stead, regarding his contest specifically with Biden. The problem on the Republican side is the Republican Party, the congressional Republicans, etc. You know, because they've unimpressed as the majority party in the House, admittedly a narrow majority, which is being whittled away quite quickly and effectively by the Democrats. But they have demoralized their voters, but they disappointed the Republican voters very much so. They haven't impressed the country as a whole either. So the Republicans in 24 are looking at an underwhelming outcome in a la 22, where they might squeak a victory, but it won't be an impressive one in terms of seats. Their hope here, what will they have to hold on to, is the opposite of what the quote-unquote experts of conventional wisdom were saying after the 22 race, which was that the problem was Trump. The problem for the Republicans in 22 is there wasn't a Trump. The good news for the Republicans in 24 congressionally is there is a Trump. So Trump is going to drag some senatorial candidates and especially some congressional Republican candidates over the finish line in races they would lose if he wasn't at the top of the ticket. I think that's something we can say with a high degree of certainty. So can Republicans congressionally survive themselves and hang on to Trump's coattails for long enough and effectively enough to pull off a majority in the Senate, which looks more likely than the House, but also in the House? And on the Democratic side, can the Biden campaign be sufficiently propelled by the Democratic Party machine, and especially its get out the vote operation and its get out the vote creation operation, that, or should I say create the vote operation, that they can not just be competitive, but pull off what at the moment would look like a surprise victory against Trump?
We shall see what happens. I think for the time being, Trump is favored to win. I don't think there's much debate about that, but we'll see what transpires. There's still a lot of time in campaign season, though. It is pretty rare for the game to turn around at this late date, although we live in a crazy period where precedent can be smashed into 1,000 pieces. But as of now, it is Trump's race to lose. Do you think that's a fair assessment, Patrick?
It is his race to lose. At the moment, you know, given how the candidates are rated, given the policy environment, everything else involved, everything that we know and can predict, it's hard to see how Trump doesn't win in the Electoral College. I think it's more likely than not that he wins the popular vote, which is unusual these days for some time for a Republican candidate. However, it's often said it's more about who counts the ballots rather than, you know, the ballots that are cast. So we know from 2020 that we can't be sure of anything at all. And we also know from 2020, even if you go by the official results, that literally 30, 40,000 votes across a few states decided everything. So if this race is close, not just nationally, but more importantly in the swing states, then, you know, it could go either way. It, you know, these things tend to get closer as we get closer to the finish line. But you have this interesting situation of you have Robert F. Kennedy Jr. doing very well for an independent candidate. Does he maintain that? Does he go up any further? If he does, does he continue to take more from Biden than from Trump? Or does he start to pick up more Trump votes? You know, either direction. If he takes more Biden votes, this could be a Trump landslide. If he, you know, it could even up, however, if he begins to take more equally from both. And then you touched on earlier, and I agree with you wholeheartedly, Joseph, one shouldn't overlook the contributions, perhaps inadvertent, of Cornel West and Jill Stein. You know, they're right now polling 1-2% nationally, similar comparable figures in the swing states. But we're talking about states, most of which were decided by thousands, tens of thousands of votes. They are going to take almost exclusively from the Biden side of the, you know, column, side of the ledger. They, you know, one of them gets 3% rather than 1%, 3% rather than 2%, 2% rather than 1%. That's enough for Trump to win a state that he otherwise might lose narrowly, right? These are all things that are still in the mix. And so it is Trump's to lose. If you were betting the House right now, you'd have to go with Trump. But we know from 2020, and we know from the fact that this is a more interesting field than we've had for some time, that it is, you would hope, you would not want to bet the House yet, because there are still some, I'm not sure if I'm paraphrasing or I'm perverting the late, great Donna Rumsfeld's comment about there are some known unknowns that remain out there that might prove decisive.
Indeed. We shall see what happens. Those words are ones that I will be echoing throughout the year. We definitely shall see what happens. It will be an interesting election cycle, which is unusual because the polling is so steadily in Trump's favor. But we shall see. Patrick, thank you very much for stopping by tonight. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you, Joseph. As always, I enjoy our conversations. I hope your viewing and listening audience have done it also. And I look forward to the next chance to talk about everything that's wild and wonderful and a little weird about American politics in 2024.
Oh, yeah, we'll be having, Patrick and I will be speaking every month through November, and probably December as well, sort of like a recap of what happened during the previous month, provided that the election is still not going on at that point. So, you know.
Whether we speak from undisclosed locations or not is to be determined, but...
it's a crazy time. So much is
you might appreciate the wonders of virtual communications via the internet even more in December than we do now.
Yes, you never know. Absolutely. I think that regardless of whoever wins, a lot of people will be very angry, and that will be very interesting, to say the absolute least. But anyway, Patrick, for sure, thanks for being here. It was a great conversation. Your numbers are enlightening, and I hope that the audience found them to be as interesting as I did. Everyone, thank you very much for having tuned in. Please stay safe, be well, and cheers.
Old Spice shampoos are scientifically crafted to help make men's hair look thicker, healthier, and more moisturized. That's because they're blended with the perfect mix of cleansing and conditioning ingredients for men's hair. Try Old Spice shampoos today and rescue your hair.
say goodbye. Got your ticket, got your suitcase, got your leaving smile. Oh, I could see that's the way it goes, and I could pretend you won't know.
Marcus is a connoisseur of anything that's free. So he was happy to read the disclaimer on TurboTax Free Edition.
Roughly 37% of taxpayers qualify. Form 1040 and limited credits only. See how at TurboTax.com. That's me!
File your taxes 100% free with TurboTax Free Edition and get your max refund guaranteed. Make your moves count. See if you qualify at TurboTax.com.